This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are the authors of the new book in which Timothy McVeigh publicly confesses for the first time that he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. He expresses no remorse and offers no apologies. The book, American Terrorist, tells the story of McVeigh's life and of the bombing. It's based on about 80 hours of interviews with McVeigh, in prison and by phone, as well as letters from McVeigh. The authors also interviewed about 150 people who have known McVeigh at various stages of his life. The authors, Lou Michelle and Dan Herbeck, are reporters with the Buffalo News and have covered the bombing since the week it happened. Lou Michelle had been writing to Timothy McVeigh, asking for an interview, when McVeigh finally decided to speak to a reporter. At his father's recommendation, he contacted Michelle. Michelle lives about 20 minutes away from where McVeigh's father lives in Niagara County, New York, and had interviewed him and established a relationship with him.
It's the oldest trick in the book when it comes to journalism. I just started burning the shoe leather and taking the long way to work, coming and going, so I would be able to pass Bill McVeigh's house. And whenever I saw him out weeding his flower beds or his vegetable patch, I would stop and say hello. And I had a common interest in my vegetable garden, and we'd talk about what works, what doesn't when it comes to fertilizer, watering the garden. In fact, one time we were talking about corn, and I said, well, I like to throw this fertilizer on it. And I just felt so stupid after that, because fertilizer was used to make the bomb, and Bill kind of gave me a wary eye.
Now, McVeigh also told you he was afraid that if you leaked anything from the book, that it could destroy his appeal. Yet he didn't seem to care about being found guilty. So why did he care about the appeal?
Well, he was using the judicial system the whole way. The trial was a platform for his anti-government views, and the appeal process was to show to highlight the faults of the judicial system. He felt that he was such a high-profile case and they made mistakes in the legal handling of his case, that he would get it on record that the judicial system had many shortcomings, from the fact that his defense team had leaked his confession to several media outlets. But the ironic thing is, it was a grandiose suicide by cop deluxe package, as he said. He just wanted to get the negative things about the judicial system on the record, and then at some unknown future point, at the time I was interviewing him, he planned to withdraw his appeal and let the government fulfill his death wish. He wanted to die. He said he had an indifference to life. And in doing that, he was going to also prove that the government was legally euthanizing him, while at the same time the government has put Jack Kevorkian in jail for conducting physician-assisted suicides. It's kind of like McVeigh's final kick at the government.
Would you describe the atmosphere of the interviews that were conducted in the prison?
Well, it's a bit intimidating when you go to these federal prisons. There's such high security, and they're trying to keep Timothy McVeigh safe and alive for his date with the executioner, so there's enormous security procedures. I was basically in the basement of what appeared to be a bunker. It was a little cubicle made of concrete, and there was a steel donut hole between us with the partition of plexiglass, inch-thick plexiglass, and there was a steel donut hole, something like when you go to a drive-through bank teller window. But when I got there and I was setting up my equipment for the interview, he flashed a smile at me and put his hand against the plexiglass to do that traditional prison handshake through the glass. And things eased up at that point. We both talked about things in common, that were Irish and Catholic. And he said, I'm going to tell you some things in these interviews, and I don't want your beliefs to interfere with mine. He was afraid that if I leaked out the fact that he wanted to die, that the government might stop his execution. And he knows I'm against the death penalty, but I said, Tim, we all have free will, and I'm not going to stand in your way if that's your free will. But about 2 hours into that interview that second day on Friday, the end of May, I could not get over how meticulously he was detailing how he came to decide to conduct the bombing, how he assembled the bomb. He gave me a 2-hour synopsis, and then over the next 2 days, we went into more depth. But at 2 hours into it, I just had this surreal feeling wash over me, and I'm thinking to myself, here I am listening to the details of an act that killed 168 people, including 19 children, injured 500 more, and psychologically devastated thousands more, right across the nation with our sense of freedom. It had been destroyed as a society. You know, when we go to free gatherings, food courts, shopping malls. So it was a pretty scary situation.
Lou, what is the most surprising thing that Timothy McVeigh told you? Like the biggest piece of the puzzle that you think he gave you?
There was, Terry, there was so much that just knocked me out of my seat. I guess it wasn't so much what he said as his demeanor in telling it. He would occasionally stop and say, I know I'm not showing any emotion or feeling, and it's because I'm a professional, I'm a soldier. He does not want to be seen as a monster. He wants to be seen as someone who has employed terrorism, a tool that's been used throughout the ages as a last resort to bring about change. He very much wants people to know that he is a human being. And yet, when you sit there and you're talking with him, you can talk for hours on end, you know, about childhood, the Buffalo Bills, the Buffalo Sabres, sports. Then the subject will change to the federal government, federal agents, and he will get a look in his eye that's filled with this glint and light, and you just sense the hatred that he has for the government coming out, and it chills you to the bone, and you say to yourself, this is the man who blew up the Alfred P. Murrah building.
One of the things he said to you when talking about the number of people who were killed in the explosion, he said, think about the people as if they were stormtroopers in Star Wars. They may be individually innocent, but they're guilty because they work for the evil empire. What was the context of that?
He was trying to show that these federal employees are all part of the federal family. And in his mind, he had come to a place where he was able to dehumanize them. They were all part of this evil force. And he talks in pop culture. He doesn't have a classical education, so he brings in Star Trek, Next Generation, Star Wars. McVeigh, in his hatred for the government, was able to marginalize all of these secretaries and children and other innocent people that were in the building. Though he's very proud of the fact that he was able to, what he says, is minimize collateral damage.
One of the things that he told you that the press has since picked up on is that really his only regret about killing the children in the daycare center was that it would detract from his anti-government message. It would overshadow that message. What was your reaction when he told you that? Did you try to just not flinch at all?
That was really one of the most astonishing things that he had told us. And any reporter trying to pursue a story like this and interview somebody like Timothy McVeigh, you really have to box up your emotions and set them aside, because otherwise you won't be able to carry on with the interview. He really took the attitude of a soldier about this entire bombing. And when he first learned about the children that perished in the bombing, he was in the little jail in Perry, Oklahoma, where he was being booked on traffic counts. And nobody had any inkling at the time that he was the bomber. He saw this on a little television set in the jail booking room, and he heard about the daycare center, and the very first thought that flashed through his mind is, this was a tactical error on my part. This is going to overshadow the political message of my bombing, and people are going to be thinking of me as a baby killer, and my political message is going to be obscured by that. And that was one of the things that most astonished us in the interviews, how clinically he could analyze something like that, putting all human emotion outside of it.
Well, did you have to start behaving in a similar fashion, putting your emotions someplace else so as to not discourage him from trusting you with more information?
We basically had to turn ourselves into human tape recorders when we did these interviews, because we could not sit there and argue with him and debate with him. We were basically just trying to get the story on tape so we could then put it on paper and let people find out what really happened in the Oklahoma City bombing. With all that said, there were times when Lou and I would get together after our interviews and we'd be shattered by some of the things we heard. And there were times we went to churches and prayed over it, and there was times when he and I were working on the story and just had tears in our eyes as we wrote some of these things.
Did you get a sense that you found out during your interviews with McVeigh what he really hoped to accomplish by the Oklahoma City bombing? I mean, did he really think that people would see the explosion on TV or witness the explosion in their hometown and think, gosh, he's right, our government has problems?
Well, he's kind of reserving judgment on that. He's hoping that at some point down the road, people will see him more as a freedom fighter than a terrorist. He recently said to me in a letter to the Buffalo News that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. He intentionally picked the Murrah building because there weren't that many other buildings around it, and it would create a photo opportunity.
What did you learn from McVeigh about the fuse that he used for his truck bomb?
He had three contingencies in order to ensure the ignition of the bomb. He had a 5-minute fuse and a 2 to 2.5 minute fuse, and then he also had a bunch of explosives piled up in a corner of the cargo bay where he could fire at them with his gun, if handgun, if need be. When he was approaching the Murrah building shortly, just around 9 a.m., Wednesday morning, April 19th, 1995, he pulled over near the Regency Tower, an apartment building, and lit the 5-minute fuse, then rolls up to a stoplight just before the Murrah building on Northwest 5th Street, and he lights the 2-minute fuse, and the cab of the Ryder truck starts to fill with smoke, and he rolls down the windows and clears the smoke out. He's waiting in the meantime for the light to turn green again. He's almost willing it to turn green, and it does, and he pulls up to the Murrah building. There's a little cut-in, and he parks the truck at the far end of the cut-in, so the back of the truck is facing the building, and that's how he'd had the bomb shaped, so that the force of it would come out the back. And he calmly gets out of the truck, locks it up, and walks across Northwest 5th up to the YMCA, gets into a system of alleyways, and that's the first time he breaks into a jog. And meanwhile, he's ticking it off in his mind, thinking to himself, well, this bomb should have blown by now. I hope I don't have to go back and shoot it, because he realizes he will lose his life because he'll be so close to the bomb when it erupts. And then the bomb does go off, lifts him off the ground an inch. Part of a brick facade topples down, a brick hits him, an electrical wire drops on the ground, it's arcing, he dodges that. And at some point, he runs into a delivery man, a man that looks like a delivery man, and the man says to him, boy, I thought that we were blowing up. And McVeigh says, yeah, me too, or or words to that effect. He didn't want to not say anything to this guy. And McVeigh later said that man was the only credible witness. And so McVeigh continues to his getaway car, and if you were in a helicopter, you'd see thousands of people, hundreds of people, heading toward the scene of the bombing, and you'd see this one yellow car going in the direction away from the city.
Did he describe all of this with a sense of pride and accomplishment?
Yes, he did, almost with an eagerness to discuss his accomplishment. And I really think that one of the psychiatrists that interviewed him, Dr. John R. Smith, really described it perfectly. He told us that when he was talking to Timothy McVeigh about the bombing, McVeigh had the enthusiasm of a young junior high school student describing a successful science experiment.
In going through the things that Timothy McVeigh told you about his childhood, did anything strike either of you as a warning sign that somebody might have picked up on years ago that he was very troubled?
I think that's one of the real problems. There were no real warning signs. People who grew up with Timothy McVeigh and people in his neighborhood just viewed him as the happy-go-lucky kid next door. And I know that sounds like a cliche, but that is how he's described. People who lived in the neighborhood were very willing to have him babysit their children, and he was the kid that was almost like the Pied Piper for the younger children in the neighborhood. But while all that was going on and while he was seeming to be very normal on the outside, his psychiatrist has told us that at night he would be in his room and he would be very fearful because sometimes his parents would have loud arguments. And he would be cowering under the covers, reading comic books with a flashlight. And he was really losing himself in a fantasy world at that time. So I don't know if there were any outward signs that people could have picked up on at that time in his life.
He dropped out of college, and it was then that he really turned seriously to, you say it's then that he turned seriously to the literature of the gun culture and to the kind of racist paranoia literature that he immersed himself in. Can you talk a little bit about the period of his life and what changed for him then?
Well, he took a job as an armed guard on a armored truck, and he embraced the gun culture, which accelerated after his time in the military. When he came home from the military, he had thought that his success in the military as a quote-unquote war hero and a sergeant would count for college. And he discovered that he was mistaken, and he returned to the same dead-end job as a security guard and making minimum wage. And it was at that point that he decided that he would go on this odyssey to find what he calls a free state, one that didn't have that much taxes and or regulations of guns. And he interestingly enough, just before he went on it, he'd had a nervous breakdown. He showed up at his grandfather's house, Ed McVeigh, in the middle of the winter. Ed lived a few miles away. He drove over in just a pair of sweatpants, no shoes or socks or top on. And he was crying, and he went up to a room in the upstairs bedroom, and he contemplated committing suicide at that point. But he didn't. He just fell asleep and realized he had to make some changes in his life. And so he goes on this odyssey of 26 months leading up to the bombing. And he fell in with the gun show culture and their far right wing of it.
Now, you mentioned that he was in the military and that helped him get deeper into the gun culture. He tried to be in the special forces after he fought in the Gulf War. But he really didn't have the physical stamina or strength for it, so he had to drop out. That seemed to be another turning point in his life, where he got really disillusioned with the military and with the government, and then off on his own got really deep into the gun show culture. Did you get the impression that that not being able to cut it in the special forces was a real turning point for him?
Yes, Terry, I do believe that. And even though he has told us repeatedly that that was not the reason that he left the Army, and it wasn't such a crushing blow as people might think it was, I firmly believe that if Timothy McVeigh had been successful in the Special Forces tryout, the course of history might have been changed, because I think he is a very, very bright, energetic person who was looking for the right place, the right thing to belong to. And I think that if he had made Special Forces, he may have been very, very successful in it. He may still be with the Army today, fighting battles, taking part in missions for our government.
Do you think he expected to survive the Oklahoma City bombing?
Absolutely. He had every intention. The last thing he wanted to do was go back to that truck and shoot it and perish at that moment, because this was all part of his message. In his getaway car, Terry, he left the license plate off intentionally. People have often wondered about that, because he's so meticulous. Why would he forget the license plate? But that was all done by design. It was the wild card he dealt himself. He knew at some point somebody in law enforcement would pull him over. He hoped that it wasn't in the state of Oklahoma, that it happened further north in Kansas. Also, inside his car...
Why was he hoping that somebody would pull him over?
He wanted to get caught, be taken into custody, and then he knew that they would trace the truck through the confidential vehicle identification number. They would identify it as a Ryder truck that was rented up in Kansas, and they would go to the Junction City Ryder dealer, get a composite of him, fan out through Junction City, and finally wind up at the Dreamland Motel, where you have Leah McGowan, the owner of it, saying, well, no, that's not Robert Kling, the alias he used to rent the truck, but it does look just like Timothy McVeigh, who spent several days here before the bombing. So he left all of these tidbits along the way in order to ensure he would get caught, including leaving the license plate off so he would be stopped and taken into custody. And he did give his real name when he was taken into custody by Oklahoma State Trooper Charlie Hanger. And inside that car, Terry, he had a white envelope stuffed with virulent anti-government literature. And in fact, one of the lines said, maybe now there will be justice, he'd handwritten, or some words to that effect. So he knew that people like you and I in the media would glom onto that, and he was basically tooling us in the media to get his points across. Of course, it was dwarfed by the fact that 19 children died in the blast.
McVeigh is now on death row in Terre Haute. He has said that if the families of the Oklahoma City bombing victims are allowed to watch his execution on closed-circuit TV as they've requested, then he'll try to get CNN or 60 Minutes to carry the execution nationally. How would he try to arrange that? What power does he think he has here?
Well, I don't think he has any power to do that. What he has, I believe he has sent letters to the major networks and told them, if you want to broadcast this, you people have the money for lawyers, you have the big-time lawyers, fight it out, and I won't stand in your way. He realizes he has no power whatsoever in this matter, but he's asking these networks to carry that fight for him. I don't think there's a chance in the world that his execution is going to be broadcast. I don't think the U.S. Bureau of Prisons is going to allow it, And we haven't heard of one network that actually is going to carry that fight. You know, nobody has really stepped forward and said, we want to broadcast the execution. It's not going to happen.
Is it fair to say that Timothy McVeigh still has no misgivings that he's expressed to you about the bombing?
I think you're right on target with that. No remorse. Dan and I went at Timothy McVeigh 20 or 30 times, rephrasing, reframing the question, are you sorry, right up until just days before the galleys were final for the book, because we knew some people in Oklahoma City would really get something out of an apology. But McVeigh, and not all the people want an apology either. They just want to see him rot. But McVeigh had absolutely no interest in apologizing or saying anything was a mistake. He has said that the fact that a daycare center was there is tragic, but he's just framed it as collateral damage. And, you know, it would have given him pause if he had known there was a daycare center there, and he would have switched targets, he says, but he can live with what he did there.
Lou Michel, your interviews with Timothy McVeigh actually started with your interviews with his father, Bill McVeigh, who lives 20 minutes away from you in Niagara County, New York. Does Bill McVeigh feel at all responsible for his son's pathology? In other words, does Bill McVeigh ever ask himself if he and his ex-wife did anything wrong in their parenting or missed any cues that something was wrong with their son? Is he tormented by guilt?
Bill is tormented, but he does not feel that he or his wife are to blame for what happened. He said, I've asked him if you could have done anything differently, would you? And he says, no. He believes he and his wife were very caring and nurturing parents as best they could. They had a rocky marriage. But he says that Timothy, his son Tim, was not raised to do something like that. And he's just heartbroken. A couple of days before the book came out, I sat down with him and I let him ask me any questions he wanted, because his son has never told him that he was the bomber until recently. And Bill was heartbroken when I explained to him that Tim considered the family collateral damage as well. You know, he said, he said that? You know, he just felt so bad about that. He still loves his son, but he feels the act itself was evil and an atrocity.
So McVeigh confessed to you before confessing to his father?
Oh, yes. He confessed to a number of people on his defense team as well, but because they were bound by attorney-client privilege, they could never say anything. I was the first person outside of that loop that he confessed to. You know, his family really didn't want to know. Jennifer McVeigh once told me, maybe it's better not to know.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Pleasure to be here, Terry.
Lou Michel and Dan Herbeck are the authors of American Terrorist, Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City Bombing. Coming up, Don Hewitt, the creator and executive producer of 60 Minutes. This is Fresh Air.